This show is provided for entertainment and informational purposes only. It should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. Neither the hosts, guests, nor any funds they may manage intends to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies.
It's an unfair game.
They're schemers. Schemers trying to control their little worlds.
Please, speak as you might to a young child or a golden retriever.
Rich get richer, that's the law of the land.
I owe you nothing!
It's just money.
This is madness! Everybody just yells and screams at each other. Nobody's civil anymore!
That's not the kind of humor we do on this show.
Put that coffee down.
I drink your milkshake.
Now you're looking for the secret.
There can be only one.
Everything becomes chaos.
Can you dig it?
Brent Johnson, welcome back. Episode 5 of the Milkshakes Markets Madness show. This is going to be the last one of 2022. And I was actually thinking we should call this, because this is 5. We're kind of getting our feet under us now. This is season 0, right? We're just kind of figuring out. That way we can roll into a new year,
right,
and call 2023 season 1 and see if we can hit that 50 episode mark next year. So, it's been kind of quiet, as you would expect, towards the end of the year, but there's been a little bit of activity, particular to what we talked about last week, which was the Bank of Japan. Do you want to highlight some of that?
Well, yeah. You know, one of the things that I thought was interesting is, you know, last week, you know, we talked about in the last episode how the Bank of Japan came out and they basically increased the amount of QE they were doing, but they also expanded the band via which the bond could trade on their yield curve control. And the point I wanted to make was that these two things are at cross purposes, and that, you know, in my opinion, it wasn't going to work. The Bank of Japan would have to come back in and, you know, immediately start doing more bond buying. And sure enough, this week they've already had to do a couple different unscheduled bond buying programs to keep yields from blowing out too high. So again, you know, how this all plays out in the short term, I don't know, but in the medium to long term, I think Japan's in a world of hurt. And I think the fact that the Bank of Japan is already, just a week later, already going out and doing unscheduled bond buys just kind of shows you why. I don't know whether that goes under markets or madness, but it's just another par for the course thing on our show here.
Yeah. Do you think, I always kind of like having this thought exercise, because I'm a firm believer that the central banks are coordinated. No one is doing anything in a vacuum, so to speak. So when they sat around and made this policy decision, number one, to widen the band, you would think, like, okay, what are the knock-on effects? What's the probability of XYZ happening before they execute it, so they know how they can respond? What do you think they really thought the market reaction was going to be? And maybe do you think they really intended to come back with this so-called unannounced purchase anyway?
You know, that's a very good question. You know, there's that old saying that, you know, or is the world run by idiots who are just putting us on, or smart people who really mean it, or vice versa? And, you know, I always wonder this with central bankers. You know, to a certain extent, you have to give them credit. They've kept the plate spinning much longer than many people thought possible. You know, I tend to think that the Bank of Japan knows that in the long term, this isn't going to work out. But, you know, they're in it. They've got to just keep doing it. They've doubled down on the policy so many times to backtrack now. Would be somewhat political suicide, even though it's not necessarily supposed to be a political institution. But I think they knew when they said that they would widen the band, that it would probably, you know, strengthen the currency, which I think they probably wanted to do. I don't know if they knew that it would strengthen it to the extent that it did in the short term. But there's a part of me that just has to believe that they're not so dumb to think that they were not going to have to come back in and do more bond purchases. I mean, in the spring, they already had to do a number of unscheduled buys and, you know, recommit to doing yield curve control to keep the banking system from imploding. So the idea that just 6 months later, everything's been fixed and they wouldn't have to do that again. Maybe it's just, I don't want to believe that they're that dumb, but I just don't think that they are.
Well, look, I think some of the best investors, I paused there for a second because I guess it's all a matter of how you measure performance, but some of the investors that I find who have a skill for creating a very intelligent narrative and then building an investment approach around that, the one that comes to mind is Kyle Bass. And Kyle, you know, in around 2011, kind of had his hedge fund, you know, he was on the doing his road show. And I mean, there was just so much content on him talking about Japan and the end of Japan's both bond market currency. And he kind of had this Paris trade on, and that never really worked out. And Japan, the market overall, has kind of been, infamously known as the widowmaker. And so this kind of also goes back to a lot of what you talk about in the dollar milkshake theory. You know, as maybe reckless as it seemed in a blink of an eye, widening the band and maybe testing how the market reacts to it, it does feel like the idea that this isn't good for Japan long term makes sense. But long term is such a relative word. I mean, it's been three lost decades. We're getting close to four. I mean, you and I, Brent, could be, you know, dust in the wind 6 feet under, and they're still playing this game.
Well, that's a fantastic point. And I've always said that I think that this is, you know, 4 years ago, I said I thought this was going to play out in 4 years. We're just now entering the fourth year. So, you know, and to be honest, I think it's going to take longer than that now. You know, it always takes longer than you think it does. And my way of approaching this has always been, if I'm right, I can't ignore the possibility that I'm right. And if I'm right, that means there's going to be huge dislocations in the markets. And as somebody who manages other people's capital, I can't ignore that risk. Now, that doesn't mean that I think everybody should sell everything they own and go do 100% of their portfolio in some of these trades that I think will eventually play out. But what I think you can't do is ignore them. And so I think you need to have hedges on in place. But the nice thing about it is the hedges that you can put in place, the asymmetry is so large that if the hedges don't pay off, your overall portfolio is not blown up, and in many ways it's not even hurt because the rest of the portfolio is doing well. But to your point, I mean, this could take a long time to play out. And you know, before I forget, you mentioned Kyle. What a lot of people don't know about that, and it actually goes exactly to what we were talking about last week. You can't save both the currency and the bond market. One of them will have to be sacrificed on the other one. When Kyle was going around kind of talking about that trade, you know, let's call it a decade ago, I don't remember the exact dates, but a decade ago, he was focusing on interest rates rising. And he was explaining the fact that if interest rates rose even 1% in Japan, that the entire economy could, you know, crumble, banking system collapse, all these different things. A lot of the stuff that we were talking about a week ago. But what most people don't realize is that he did that trade as a pair trade. And so while he thought that he was going to make money shorting the bonds, in addition to shorting the bonds, he bought put options on the currency because he knew one of them would have to fall and the other one would rise. Now, he thought he was going to make a bunch of money on the bonds. He didn't, but he made a killing on the currency, and he made more on the currency than he lost on the bonds. So a lot of people think that he blew up on that trade. He didn't. He actually made a killing on the trade. He just didn't make it in the way he thought he would. And I think that's a very good way to think about what we were talking about last week. And if you didn't see last week's episode, I would encourage the listeners to go listen to it. Because again, all the programs that would be set in place to save the bond market will hurt the currency market. And anything that would be set in place to save the currency market will hurt the bond market. You know, Kyle was smart enough to know that he could be wrong. And he figured out a way to put the trade on, and that regardless of which way it went, he was going to make money. And it worked out for him. Now, it didn't work out the way that he thought it was going to work out. But again, he kind of put his, he had a way to protect himself if he was wrong. And it actually worked out quite well. Most people don't know that story. I don't know if he's told too many people that. I don't know if he likes me telling that or not, but I know that that's what happened. So anyway, I think it's a pretty interesting, way to think about what you just said, that these things can take a really long time to play out. But it's also a way to think about what we talked about last week when one of these things has to give.
Yeah, I don't know if he went around screaming from the hilltops how that played out, but I did see a clip at one point, probably like a CNBC thing, where he did explain that he got the bonds wrong, but he got the currency right, and he kind of left it at that. It wasn't He wasn't patting himself on the back. But that's why I say I think there's people who are really good. Part of what you know you guys do when it comes to managing a book, you know, you need to attract capital, and I think the dollar milkshake theory is a perfect example of how you build a story around an investment strategy. And I think so many people get caught up in the narrative and the core concept of what you're as a money manager, as a hedge fund manager, you're trying to say, and they think it's this like all in one way bet that the dollar is going to fail. Or in Kyle's case, you know, and that's why I say it's like people are good with narratives, but also good at, you know, structuring a portfolio around that and placing things in a very asymmetric way where, you know, one of the things I've taken away from having conversations with Jason Buck at Mutiny is the idea of being long GDP and having these hedges that are asymmetric, right? So if you get, you know, the end of the world scenario right, you get that payout. But otherwise, you're kind of riding the tailwinds of you know, positive economic growth. You know, and speaking of narratives and whatnot, I'll let you comment on that if you want, but I also want to throw this in here really fast. I think a really potent narrative all year around kind of the inflation concept was, you know, oil to 300. And you know, you had the Ukraine war, which put a lot of, you know, emphasis behind that argument. And, you know, friends of ours like, you know, Cuppy, he's come out and said, you know, 2023 is now going to be the year of oil. And really smart people who can articulate their ideas well, like the pen name Doomberg, you know, has made similar types of points. And so from a narrative standpoint and going into a new year, you know, I would say that these guys, they have a strong narrative, but they're also structuring, you know, a portfolio in a hedge type of way. But what are your thoughts on maybe that narrative being a little too strong?
Well, again, I don't, you know, as somebody who has made a couple calls that people think are a little bit outlandish or crazy, you know, I kind of respect when somebody has the guts to do that. You know, when Cuffy says $300, he believes it, and he's not afraid to say it, and he's not afraid to put money on the line in order to try to capitalize on it. So I have full respect for that. You know, whether it works out or not, you know, I don't know. But I think, you know, someone like Cuffy or someone like Kyle or, you know, they have used narratives to kind of drive their investment thesis. And I think I think it's a great way to do it. It's a great way to communicate what you're trying to say. And that is why I have always used narratives, because I've always worked with individuals. And I think sometimes there's this kind of a negative is being given, oh, he's just talking his book. He's just talking his narrative. Well, why would I talk somebody else's book? Why wouldn't I talk my book? If I didn't believe in my book, why would my book look the way it looks? You know what I mean? And so I kind of laugh at that. And then, you know, storytelling is very powerful. And I think it's a lost art in some ways. You know, one of my, the Russell Napier, one of my favorite guys is Russell Napier. And he's one of the best financial storytellers there is. And I think the reason I like his stuff is he always throws in a little history. He throws in a little razzle dazzle. He makes you think. But it's even if it wasn't about finance, it's an interesting story. But it is about finance. And I think, especially in today's day and age, and especially post 2008, and I thought that, you know, both the book, the Big Short, and the movie The Big Short did a very good job of kind of demystifying some of these complex terms or the financial lingo that gets thrown around with finance a lot of times, and just kind of told a very simple story in very simple terms. And when you tell a simple story in simple terms, it actually becomes more powerful than if you tell it in very complex terms that nobody understands. And so I'm kind of a fan of using a narrative to get your point across. Now, that doesn't mean you always have to stay with your narrative, and it doesn't mean your narrative can't change. But, you know, when I think back to Cuffy's call on $300 oil, I think it's a little high. I actually think in the short term, oil probably goes lower, but I could easily see $150 oil next year. That wouldn't shock me at all. And, you know, whether it actually ever gets to 300 or not, it doesn't really matter. The point is he has a strong conviction. He has very good reasons behind it, and he's willing to put his name on the line and say it. And I have respect for that. Whether it works out or not, I have respect for that.
Yeah, and again, like we're saying here, he also knows how to structure his investments around that so he doesn't blow up and he can catch that asymmetric. I mean, that's him and his multi-baggers is
yeah,
pretty much yeah. how I met Cuppy, pounding the table on multi-baggers. But you know, that's it's true, you know, facts tell, stories sell. And we're doing a lot of name dropping on this episode, but I think a perfect example is when I think of the king of the Euro dollar story, I think of Jeff Snyder. And as long Absolutely. as long as I've been diving down that rabbit hole and following Jeff, I get so lost in the weeds with him still. And I think, you know, versus what you've been able to do using the dollar milkshake as painting that picture, I think it's a brilliant example of, like, you can be the smartest person in the world, understand something better than anybody, but there's a bit of that saying, like, you know, you don't really understand until you can explain it to a 5-year-old. And if anything, Brent, yeah, you're right. Really good at talking to 5-year-olds, which generally we all behave like on Twitter.
5-year-olds love milkshakes. What can I say?
Right? Yeah, exactly. So look, on the state of narratives and, you know, your own story, what are you seeing in the market right now? We've had some interesting things kind of playing out in the currencies, and do you want to unpack that a bit?
Well, yeah, I just think, you know, we're basically at the end of the year. This week, the last week of the year is typically pretty quiet. I'm really kind of interested to see what happens tomorrow, whether we have a big up day, a big down day, or whether it's just, you know, nothing at all. In general, as of right now, I kind of think that at some point in January, we're going to get a rally. Based on, you know, new year flows coming into the markets, people positioning. You know, we've had kind of a pretty fairly large drawdown again over the last 2 or 3 weeks. I think we need to get a bounce, get some of the people bulled back up, draw some of the speculators back into the long assets to provide the fuel for what I think will be new lows in 2023. I think that we will revisit the lows from last year. I think we will go below them. And then I think it's very possible we have a repeat of 2020 where, you know, we have a big sell-off and then a big rally, either due to a change of monetary policy or some other outside catalyst. Now, first thing I'll say is, can I be wrong? Of course I can be wrong. And, you know, this is not set in stone, and I don't have my portfolio set up in a way that I can't change it. Of course I can change it. But that's kind of how I see it playing out right now. You know, it wouldn't shock me at all to see kind of another bear market rallies. Bear market rallies, you know, you very rarely see 15 or 20% rallies over a month period in a bull market. You typically only see those in a bear market. And, you know, I think 2 days ago, the NASDAQ was back pretty close to its low of September, and it had a good bounce today. But, you know, I do think that there is more pain to come. I think that, you know, a lot of the interest rate hikes that the Fed has made, they're probably just now starting to show up in the economy. You know, typically these interest rate hikes take 9 to 12, sometimes even 18 months to show up in an economy. Sometimes I think there's been so many rate hikes this year that people forget that the first one only happened 8 or 9 months ago.
Yep.
So we could just now be seeing those effects. And I think by the time we get it to the end of Q1 or beginning of Q2, a lot of those effects are starting to show up in the global economy. And I think we'll see lower asset prices.
Yeah. As someone who runs a mortgage company, I'm very, very tied to what goes on in the bond market. And this is one of the things strategically we're talking about, or what I'm presenting to my team, is that the Fed raised 425, 450 basis points in roughly 8 months. I mean, there's plenty of charts out there to show you how aggressive of a policy response to the inflation numbers this has been. You just don't see that work its way through the economy overnight. And, you know, one of the sayings is, as housing goes, the economy goes, and maybe that's vice versa. But housing is a very slow moving market, whether it's the catalyst or the consequence. And so you're just starting to see, you know, we have 4 consecutive months where housing is kind of rolled over and is declining. You know, the likelihood of us having a 2009 style crash isn't quite there, but, you know, the underlying loan scenarios and credit worthiness of the borrowers is much healthier. But still, you're just starting to see the knock-on effects of that. I mean, you don't have 7% 30-year fixed mortgage rates and think housing comes out of this unscathed. So I'm in agreement. I think, you know, we've got where it leaks into the market and asset prices is anybody's guess, but I don't think we're done bleeding.
Yeah, you know, I had to laugh the other day as every morning I walk to coffee. It's about 3 or 4 blocks from my apartment. And since I moved here 1.5 years ago, there's been this empty office building that's been being worked on. They've been working on it literally every day since I moved here. And it's a nice looking building. And I've always, what is going to be in there? You know, and it gets a little nicer and a little nicer. And pretty soon it looks like it's going to open, and then it never does. And then finally, today I was walking to get coffee, and the name of the company is on the door. It's a mortgage company. I had to just start laughing. I was like, "Oh boy, okay." You know, well, again, so I don't know if that goes under. I don't know if that goes under markets or if it goes under madness. But I just thought, wow, you finally get ready to roll, and now we've got 7% mortgages.
Yeah, and in a place like Puerto Rico where. Yeah. Now is not the time to unpack the complications of lending there, but we'll see how that unfolds. Maybe that's one of those classic indicators that the top is just finally in, and we still have some further to go, or at least the bear market rally top is in. Going into a new year, this is kind of a fun question. We'll say the Fed specifically, but you can approach this from a central banking standpoint. What do you think their New Year's resolutions are as central bankers?
What do I think central bank's resolutions? Wow, that's a good one. To tell the truth, I don't know. That's a good question. I think their resolution is probably, to keep doing what they've been doing. I mean, they've been, they've kept these plates spinning forever. It's really amazing. I'm not a fan of theirs, but I do give them credit for keeping the game going. And I think Powell, to a certain extent, I've said this before, is I think he's about the most clearly spoken central banker that I've come across. Now, doesn't mean he's going to be successful. Maybe he will fail spectacularly. But to me, his message has been very clear, and there's been no, mystery of what he's trying to do. Whether they can ultimately, slay this inflation dragon and get us back into a normalized market, I think is unlikely that they can get us back into a normalized market. My guess is it's going to swing back and forth between inflation and deflation and probably a little bit of both, because, that's the worst case scenario. And I think that they've kind of driven us into the worst case scenario. So I struggle to come up with a good resolution for them.
Yeah, I can't imagine that, my opinion of sociopathic central bankers is that they're probably not sitting around with an empty pad of paper thinking about, resolutions at all. But I figured I'd throw that one at you. Well, look, Brent, here we are at the 20-minute mark. This was, I think, a good chat to kind of look at overall, the way you're approaching these uncertain times and certainly what we've seen this past year. And we're rolling into probably more of the same, a lot of uncertainty and the final curtain call probably hasn't happened yet. And so I'm glad we got to sneak.
Before we sign off, I think you just hit a nail on the head that I would recommend that everyone's New Year's resolution is to get rid of any certainty that you have. I've talked about that a lot this year. I think certainty is way overrated and way overused, and I think people have way too much certainty. If you think back to February, everybody was certain that inflation was here to stay, and there was no way that, the Fed could raise rates as much as they could do without causing a global calamity. And maybe they still will, but here we are at the end of the year. Remember, oil was at 130 at one point. Oil's at 75 bucks. Inflation's now coming down a little bit. The Fed has hiked rates 400 basis points, and we're still here. We're still spending. And so rather than, finding your narrative and being married to it and having no flexibility, understand what could cause the narrative to go this way and that way. And that way you're kind of prepared for whatever comes. Again, nothing wrong with narratives, but, you've got to have some flexibility in there. And I think certainty is just going to be a killer over the next couple of years.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I'd like to throw something right on top of that. The saying, the Mark Twain quote, I believe, or maybe it was Hemingway. I always get it confused. But the question of how did you go broke, and it was slowly, then all at once. And 2023 could literally be a repeat of 2022. So part of that certainty is everyone's so certain this is going to turn into a crash. We could just exhaust ourselves waiting for that big pivot one way or the other. And so people need to be prepared for that too, because it really is, you know, the market can beat you down until you just have, you know, nothing left in you. And that's when you miss the opportunity because you've gone in too aggressively on your convictions, or you haven't maintained that flexibility. So that's it, man. I think we'll wrap up here and go stretch out a bit, maintain our own flexibility and roll into the new year. Do you have any plans for the holiday or for the big bang?
No, man, I'm 50 now, man. It's just, I'm an old guy. I'll probably be watching TV on the couch, but the season zero in the bag, looking forward to season one in 2023.
Sounds good. So you catch us on milkshakespod.com, milkshakespod on Twitter, milkshakespod on YouTube. Again, keep the comments coming. We love the interaction. Thanks for everyone who's following us, and we'll see you in 2023. Thanks, Brent.
Happy New Year. Mm-hmm.